and welcome to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with you every Tuesday at noon and Friday at 6 p.m. And if you can't do that, you can always listen to all the shows at the voiceofvashon.org website. Real Talk is the show that explores questions large and small, so I ask a question and I look for an expert to help us explore it. Today's question: can today's men, most of whom have grown up with the dominant definition of manhood, become allies to women as they reach for gender equality? My guest today is Dr. Gary Barker. He is CEO and president of Promundo Global, an organization that has spent 20 years working to redefine manhood in the U.S., Brazil, Portugal, Congo, the U.K., and who knows where else. Welcome back, Gary.
Thanks for having me.
It's a delight. I am so fascinated by your work, and as we discussed right before we came on the air, my original interest in bringing you back was to talk about your research on gender allyship among men. And then you put out another report on the impact of the man box on social and financial impacts of the man box. So that brings me to two questions. I think the first is, you can perhaps give our listeners a little summary of Promundo's mission, what you've been doing for 20 years.
Yeah, so I started it with colleagues in Brazil with the kind of simple but I guess still revolutionary idea that gender equality needs men, that is, you know, achieving full equality for women vis-a-vis men economically, socially, politically, et cetera, needs men as part of this struggle, this fight, making it real, and also that men need gender equality. We are better human beings, we live longer, we love better, we're happier if we as men also embrace gender equality. And so we work across the countries you listed, about 20 that we partner with at any given time, trying to put that into practice, carrying out research on where men are on this issue, and then trying to carry out policy and advocacy and program work to figure out how we can shift so that men become better allies and in the process get sort of be healthier and happier themselves as well.
Huge.
Sounds easy.
That's a huge, yeah, right. I'll just roll that out, right?
Yeah.
So I'm curious about a couple of things. I love the concept. I love the name of the concept, the man box. Tell our listeners what that is.
Mm-hmm. So we borrowed this idea, or were inspired by an idea that Paul Kibble, who's an activist in Oakland, California, doing some engaging men as allies work, came up with probably not going to get the number right. It's probably more than 20 years ago. As a way, you know, to step out of the sociological speak, we in the field of gender and gender studies have lots of other words we use to talk about these ideas about manhood, hegemonic masculinity as one of them. And then, you know, lately we've had the expression toxic masculinity, which many men hear as kind of, oh, you think all men are bad. And so we went back to Paul Kibble's definition of saying, you know, the man box really resonates and kind of is clearly, most folks immediately got what we meant, as the box is a great metaphor. It is a way that we keep men boxed into a notion that men don't seek help. We've got to act tough. We've got to act stoic. We think that certain things are not our realm, caring for children, caring for others, stopping to ask for directions, caring for ourselves. that somehow there's this, you know, kind of real but, you know, fake box that keeps us from doing those things. And so we thought it was a really good conceptual way to get it across that didn't necessarily turn men off. And we find that more men kind of resonated to that and kind of, oh, yeah, that sort of makes sense. I do feel it in my own life. It's something that restricts me from being, you know, kind of breaking free of these strictures. So felt like it worked. We've gotten good resonance with it. We've designed some research around it and think, you know, thanks to Paul and others who came up with that term, we think it's a better one in some ways than the toxic masculinity talk. So that's where we came up with the concept, and then we put it into use in a research project.
Yeah, I would guess that it resonates with a lot of men on a very personal scale. In other words, I would guess that there's a bit of a relief in saying, oh, you don't have to conform to these rigid ideals of manhood.
Yeah, it does. I mean, in a sense of, so let's, you know, we can have more open conversations that don't feel like you're being critiqued for, you know, something that is inside you, but essentially we're saying, look, it's a socially constructed idea here that causes harm to lots of us. And, you know, let's talk about, as we talk about breaking that box down, we can start thinking about what would you like to fill, you know, if we're to come up with a new man box or to make to squish it all together, how do we help men also come up with the qualities that most of us think, you know, good humans are about? Caring for others, being connected, you know, being full-hearted when we're at the table instead of pretending like we have to be, you know, go along with pack mentality, let's say. Living up to our word, you know, not taking consent of any form in any space for granted. Most men, when we stop being defensive, can see those things as good qualities. So I think it gives us a better way to sort of hold up masculinity and manhood with a sort of critical x-ray, but without men feeling like we're throwing them out in the process.
Ah, yeah. I have heard some folks over the years, particularly since the women's movement started in the 70s, say things like men don't really know what they're supposed to do anymore. They don't know what their value is anymore. So you did research on the man box and came up with some information about the social and financial impacts of the man box and how it's affected us all over the years. Can you give us some idea of what you found?
Yeah, the big headline, so we've carried out similar research now in more than 40 countries around the world with another research set that's got some of these same questions to men. And then we did a specific set of questions and a scale that we came up with called the Man Box Scale that we carried out with younger men, ages 18 to 30, U.S., U.K., Mexico. It's since been carried out in Jamaica and also in Australia. And what we found, somewhat similar things in, you know, a fairly wide mix of countries, which is a lot of young men, we'd like to think that they're, you know, a generation that so many new opportunities have been created for young women. We'd like to think that our sons and young men are on board with this as well. But what we found was the general acceptance of young men that women are their equals. And yet there's still a strong clinging to this version of manhood means I've got to show I'm tough. I've got to get respect with force and violence, even if necessary. I've got to know where my female partner is all the time. I've got to show, I don't stop and ask for directions or ask for help. I'm more likely to play through the pain than I am to stop and say, uh-oh, you know, maybe I do need some help here. So large percentages of young men in all the countries where we ask still believe in that. And the more you believe in that cluster of ideas, the more likely you are to harass, to bully, to drink too much, to have been in a traffic accident, to be depressed, to have thought about suicide. Really, really clear associations with all of those. So that, you know, the equation that comes out is the more you're in the box, the more you're causing harm to others and you're causing harm to yourself. Now, it's 40 to 50% of the guys who are kind of saying, yes, they agree with that idea of manhood in about half the questions. So the good news is, you know, we've got a box half empty story here. Which is a lot of guys are kind of not quite sure. A lot of them, you know, will change their ideas if they see other men around them supporting these more positive ideas about masculinity. But the issue, you know, that we take is it's alive and well. It's far too alive and well. We can see what it's led to of, you know, some voting patterns in some parts of the world in terms of men feeling their sense of manhood, you know, is under attack and is threatened. But what was really resounding in the study is the more you're in this box, the more you cause harm to others and to yourself, the more you're out of it, the more likely you are to be happy, connected, and not to cause harm to others or to yourself. Then the next piece of research that we did was there's still a lot of skepticism of, yeah, well, you know, it's just a lot of talk.
Mm.
And we said, well, actually, all these associations hold up conceptually. That is, there's a lot of other research about men's health. In fact, we did a review of the global burden of disease, plus about 500 references out there that show the main things that ail men in terms of health, 7 of the 10 of them are directly related to social norms. That is, they're not biologically driven, they're not driven by infectious disease agents, They are risk-taking behaviors that are driven in large part by how we're socialized as men.
Things like drinking dangerous driving, fighting?
Diet, driving.
Diet.
Work-related accidents. Men eat, we take less care of our bodies in terms of what we eat. We're also less likely to seek preventive care. We're more likely to put our bodies in situations where we're at risk. And, of course, violence is one of the external violence and suicide. We often forget that suicide is mostly a male phenomenon. Two-thirds in the world, and then in some countries, the U.S., it's 75% of suicides are men. So clearly there's something going on that's not a, if there's a biological factor related to that, that's the tiniest amount of it. The bigger portion of it is the socialization, the settings we live in, and these ideas about manhood. And so what we did is we took that data from the first study and said, these negative outcomes that I just listed, harassment, bullying, violence against women, binge drinking, traffic accidents, suicide, depression, those all have costs associated with them that are both cost to the health system, whether public or private, lost life, which economists and health economists put a numerical value on that's kind of agreed upon around the world, and it's got lost work, among other things. But those three things you can measure because countries keep data on that. Insurance companies and ministries of health keep data on that of what these things cost. That's how they come up with health budgets, and that's how insurance companies set premiums and figure out how much they're going to have to pay for these things because they know how often they happen and what they cost.
So it's risk assessment.
So it's risk assessment. So basically for those six outcomes that I listed, traffic accidents, suicide, bullying and violence, but we lump together their bullying and gender-based violence and harassment, depression and binge drinking, we can come up with a price tag of how much the man box or these ideas about manhood are involved in those costs. They're not the only cause, but they're directly implicated in the U.S. They're directly implicated in $16 billion of cost every year just in the group, just in the age group of 18 to 30.
$16 billion in the U.S. alone.
Billion a year. Yep. So what is that? That's more than the revenue of the NBA every year. That is one and a half, almost twice the size of the budget of the Centers for Disease Control, which is our health prevention and research arm of the U.S. federal government. There's lots of other comparisons you can do it to. That's about how much we spend on breast cancer treatment every year. We know the huge rates of that. And that doesn't count lots of other costs in women's lives who end up picking up the pieces after men have had accidents, or households that don't have men because they've died or killed themselves or been killed by others. So we know there's a lot of other costs that we'd associate with masculinities in the man box, but at a minimum, $16 billion. The UK, it's $4 billion. That would solve the deficit of the UK's public health system, the national health system, their NHS. That is twice what they spend every year on tea. To give you another, another big number to go by in terms of just how big these numbers are. So clearly, it's not the only thing. It wouldn't solve everything, but it is big enough that we kind of need a warning label that would be the equivalent of, on the pack of cigarettes. Surgeon General warns, smoking leads to these effects. We could kind of, we could say more than kind of. We could say this merits from Centers for Disease Control or the Surgeon General, the man box, harmful ideas about manhood, is bad for your health and the health for others around you.
Gary Barker, President and CEO of Promundo Global, how do you plan to use these numbers? Are these numbers going to be motivation for, you can't make cultural change just by making laws, but it seems to me you might affect insurance companies? How can you use these numbers to further your goal of sort of breaking open the man box?
I mean, well, one, I'll start with the partner that worked with us on the study is Axe, the Unilever brand that makes deodorant and other grooming products for young men. They have been our partner in this. And if you've got some spare time and you want to watch Axe ads over the years, they have in the last few years in partnership with us and others, they've shifted how they talk about masculinity in their ads. So, you know, if they used to be kind of a James Bondy, you know, if guy's got to pick up every woman every opportunity he gets, and, you know, he's tough and he never stops and he beats people up, they've now shifted to a version that says, make your own manhood. There's no set way, you know, be your authentic self and a self that doesn't harm and hurt others. So one is, you know, harnessing the power of big brands, which Gillette also, you know, under Procter & Gamble just did a really thoughtful and provocative ad on talking about, you know, is this the best men can be? I think one of the ways that we look at shifting culture is that. Let's change the way that ads that have, you know, and particularly big corporations like Unilever and P&G, I mean, they control 50% of the global ad revenue in the world. So if we get them saying positive things about manhood, that's a huge way to go. Sports is another way. Engaging the big leagues, which some groups do already, of trying to promote healthy manhood, using, you know, the big impact they have on the world to do it. Schools. Mm. We've tested many others. We have a curriculum called Manhood 2.0 that CDC has funded us to do some impact evaluation with. If we can get young men to come through a critical discussion of what these ideas about manhood mean, building that into the school curriculum or after school curriculum. We've got similar approaches, of course, that many organizations have been doing with young women to promote, you know, their voice and also entrance into the workplace and STEM professions and the like. We think the parallel piece that we can do in schools is some evidence-based approaches that show results in terms of improved understanding of consent, reductions in violence in some cases when we can have the activities go on long enough, reductions in bullying, for example. So school is another place where this stuff can happen. Parent training. I mean, we as parents, fathers and mothers, have a huge role in building and reinforcing these roles. So including within parent training, these discussions of how we raise our daughters to have, you know, their full voice in the world, yeah, and how we raise our sons to understand consent and healthy ideas about manhood.
So many prongs to the notion of redefining manhood, and it sounds like you really have a handle on that. You're listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and I'm here with Dr. Gary Barker of Promundo Global, whose work is focused on softening the idea of manhood. And we can do this thanks to Windermere Vashon Real Estate. They support all our community information programming, and they make our emergency alert service possible. You can find them on the web at windermerevashon.com. So, Gary, with all these wonderful prongs, obviously you're trying to harness the power of the media, which does so much to shape our ideas of the ideal man and the ideal woman. And how much, I'm curious, of what you do has to do with changing women's ideas of masculinity. In other words, so many women want the bad boy. And how can we change that notion?
Yeah, I think, you know, I do think it's got to be kind of, we're all in this together, right? I mean, we'll sometimes, you know, jokingly say that women are also, you know, consumers and producers and makers of men and manhood as well.
Yeah.
You know, this is not to blame women ever for the harmful behavior of men, but we're in this together as we shape ideas of what masculinity looks like. The number of mothers who I've talked to said, you know, I kind of know a clear pathway toward how to help my daughter see the world as hers. But I have real, you know, and even connecting with her about her emotional fears and helping her find her voice and reinforcing a notion that, you know, she should be all that she can be, both in whatever kinds of relationships and if she wants to have children or doesn't, and then also in, you know, the professional and the outside the home world as well. But how much difficulty mothers say they have talking to their sons. And then, you know, men we often know it's been easier for us to relegate sort of child rearing as your job as women. And so the difficulty is, you know, how do we bring men in as full-on, hands-on caregivers,
yeah,
not the helper, right? Getting rid of the words of, oh, yeah, I'm here to help,
right,
I'm here to babysit, and said, no, you're here to be a caregiver, period. You can do everything but breastfeeding you can do. Now, the number of women who will then come back and say, well, no, but I'm actually biologically inherently better at some of this stuff, and say, you might want to think you are, but actually you're not. What we need to do is figure out how, you know, men can do all this stuff, including we can remember birthdays. It's been proven. We can actually remember some of this stuff. So even the stuff that's called the mental load and the psychological load, there is, you know, and I'm not questioning women's perceptions that men aren't doing our share of this. And you could, you know, talk to my, you know, wife, whether I'm doing those things or not, or my daughter or whatever, but to say, and you should, don't just take my word for it. But we can, you know, we can learn those things. And I think it is also about, yes, you know, we need women on board with this as well and saying, what are we all doing to reinforce some of these notions? But we also need men to do our share of the caregiving and hands-on caregiving, which I think is a huge driver of the change. And I think the other part is to be clear about, you know, we're not trying to, most of what, you know, we want men to do better, most men already know those things and already think those are the right things to do. You know, this is not about teaching men to be some kind of men they've never been before. Most of we know what consent looks like. We know what respect looks like. We know what hands-on caregiving looks like. It's trying to create this kind of cultural shift that men can do those things. And we're not judging, you know, muscle size, you know, what kind of tattoos you might have or whatever we might brand as kind of tough guy masculinity on the outside. None of those things are really what we're talking about. We are talking about full respect, full equality, full belief in consent, full belief that I need to seek help when I need it, not pretend that I don't need it, and I only seek help at the moment that I'm on the edge of suicide or you know, some deep spiral of depression.
Well,
those
and that,
things that, yeah.
That brings us to your study on male allyship for gender equality, and there are some interesting findings in that you said men say they're more aware of and more likely to take action when they see discrimination against women than they were a year ago. Tell us more about those findings. How does your study on male allyship for women intersect with the whole idea of breaking the man box?
Yeah, I think we did this study in partnership with Bonobos, the men's clothing brand, that and several other groups have done some similar studies. So it's a nationally representative study, men and women, ages 25 to 45, asking about, you know, where men are, what do men say they're doing, and what do women say they see men are doing. And, you know, I think what very consistent finding there is that, and the good news is that, most men either say they agree with gender equality, 70% plus said there should be more women in positions of political power. So you want to say, great, men, why aren't we voting in those directions? 60% of men, so nearly two-thirds, say we should have more women as leaders in the workplace. So again, you want to say, so what are we doing to make that happen? Two-thirds of men see the barriers that women face in the workplace. So, you know, men are not blind to this stuff. Almost 90% so they're doing everything with who have female partners, saying, yeah, I'm doing everything to support, you know, my female partner's career. Then, you know, 77% of men, so again, you know, it's a big majority, saying they're doing everything they can to support gender equality in their workplace. So you've got this massive men are on board with gender equality, and you'd love to say, wow, we're kind of done with it, aren't we? And then you ask women. And, you know, then the numbers are far less. So only 41% of women said men in their workplace are doing everything to support gender equality. We asked about whether women at their workplace thought that men would be good listeners about discrimination or harassment. Vast majority of men said, yes, I'd be a good listener. Only half of women think that men at their workplace would be good listeners.
So where's that disconnect?
Yeah, where's the gap? So, yeah, where's the gap? Is it that, you know, we as men in our heads, like, are being, you know, we're being allies for you, you just can't hear us because we're, you know, we're just thinking it really loudly, but we're not saying it? I think that's a piece of it. I think what was interesting is that both men and women say for men to step up around these issues in the workplace or among their peer groups is a risk for men.
Yes.
And what is the risk? We're questioning the status quo. We risk getting, you know, shouted down by another guy who goes, you know, huh, what are you making such a big deal? You know, whose team are you on? After all, women and men both recognize in kind of equal numbers that for men to speak out with this is kind of fraught. The other thing that can happen to us when we speak out as men is that either we kind of step in clumsily, or that sometimes women are kind of like, shut up, this isn't your cause, you don't know how to be an ally. So I think there's also a risk from women's rights allies who have kind of been like, well, you know, we've been trying to get you guys to shut up, we don't need you to say more now. And I think it is important to acknowledge it's confusing for men.
Yeah.
And that's not to let men off the hook, but it is to say, all right, it's confusing for you, so let's listen to what women say you could do. How about, in doubt, what we tend to do, you know, a good thing to do in a moment of confusion is to stop and ask directions.
not be afraid to make mistakes. And see that it's risky for men who want to be approved of by the male world to take action in behalf of women. But women who want them to take action really need to allow them to make those mistakes so they can learn from them have enough support and courage to actually risk the rejection of the guy world, if you will.
Yeah, and I think it is trying to figure out that ground that says, okay, there's a reason that women are angry at some men and maybe angry at a lot of men for either harm caused or for staying quiet when other men cause that harm. That anger is absolutely, it's necessary. It's, you know, it's a part of the women's rights revolution. There's been a lot of, you know, amazing women writers writing about the importance of women's anger, no question about it. And then after that anger, or even during it, we have to say, so what happens next?
Right.
You know, we need men to listen better. We need men to, we've got to figure out what our power and privilege means in the workplace and at home. And that's not to sit there stewing in some guilt, but it is to say, let's be aware of this and to figure out how it means we've got to come up with policies that sometimes include and need to include affirmative action. This is fairness. This is, you know, you may think this sounds like tokenism and hiring somebody who's less qualified. This is about fairness. So let's be kind of willing to stay in that discomfort and say some of this is going to be a challenge. It's about giving credit when credit is due. And so making sure that, you know, we as men are socialized from early on to kind of jump in with the idea, run ahead with it, claim it as our own, you know, take all the space that we can. It is hard to go, I need to be quiet here. On the other hand, it is, we need you to speak up in thoughtful ways of how to call out other men.
Well, and I can't believe it, but we're running out of time. And I'm seeing this, I'm sure you know this to be a generational project. And on your website, you have 23 different programs underway worldwide, which fascinates me in and of itself. But I'm curious about Manhood 2.0. You're bringing that into the schools, I presume. So
when we can get it into the school curriculum, we've developed teacher training material that's online in a few countries. We've had some good experience with after-school programming in the U.S. It's been tough, you know, a challenge, of course. There's some great school districts. We have a very locally run school system in the U.S., right, where funding comes out of states, and then it's, you know, local school boards, et cetera. So it's, you know, getting it into the school curriculum is kind of, you know, one state, one school board at a time. But what we're trying to do is make these materials, and there's lots of other great organizations doing work like this. We link to some of them in the U.S. on our website in a part of the page called The Future of Manhood. There's a few examples of others on our website of other groups doing great school-connected work. It's hard to get this into curriculum because lots of decision-making around it. Lots of school districts are squeamish of talking about equality and about gender, you know, and about gender and sexual diversity. Consent means you also have to talk about sex, and that's a frightening one as well. But I think there's a lot of great ideas out there. I think it's about finding, you know, kind of brave enough voices that are parents and teachers and coaches and workplaces that are willing to say, we're willing to ask the tough questions. Manhood 2.0 is there. It's one of the tools that's available, and there's lots of others.
Well, and in the last 20 seconds, please tell us what the website is for Promundo Global.
Yeah, it's Promundo Global, all run together, P-R-O-M-U-N-D, global.org. And we've got lots of materials there, results of our research stuff, the future of manhood, which is, you know, put that title in there, it comes up on your server, leads you to a page with some videos and some kind of starting the discussion with young men, which we think is, you know, get it started. And then if you're, you know, brave enough, ready to go down the other pathways, there's lots of tools there that you can use.
Gary Barker, CEO and President of PromundoGlobal.com. I cannot thank you enough for joining us here on Real Talk. I think we have to bring you back. There's so much more to talk about.
Thanks a lot for having me, Susan.
And thanks to you listeners for joining us here on Real Talk. Send your questions to me if you have a question you'd like us to explore. We'll find an expert at realtalk@voiceofvashon.com. Thanks for listening.